Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's role as the world's leading superpower. The job of U.S. president is one which has great impact beyond its own borders. But Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have very different ideas about the role of the U.S. abroad. What is America's place in the world today? And how would Trump and Harris shape that role? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. Plenty on this edition. We're going to look at the policies of Kamala Harris and Donald Trump on the most important election issue.
It was true when Clinton said it. It's going to be true about this election. Number one issue people are all talking about is the economy.
Our correspondent Michelle Fleury is going to be taking a close look at the crucial speeches they both made in the last 36 hours on that very issue. And more problems for Boeing. But we're going to start this program in South Asia, in Pakistan, where the country's prime minister's office has said that the International Monetary Fund, one of the world's most important financial agencies, has agreed to provide the country with $7 billion of funding. That's led to headlines like this across the country.
اہم اور بڑی خبر آپ کو دیں آئی ایم ایف کے ایگزیکٹو بورڈ نے پاکستان کے لیے نیا قرض پروگرام
We haven't as yet had confirmation from the IMF, but plenty of comments coming from Shahbaz Sharif's office in Pakistan. The country, of course, has been going through one of the worst economic crises that it has faced since independence. That has led to many professionals leaving the country. Dr. Abid Jamail is a doctor who's based in Karachi.
Most of the qualified doctors either have left Pakistan or they are in process to leave Pakistan because of the circumstances, because of economical issues and security issues here in Pakistan. And this is going to cause another big issue here in Pakistan, because when you have no qualified physicians, when you have no qualified engineers and others, who is going to run this country?
We wanted to get a sense of where Pakistan is economically. We're going to hear from a former governor of the country's central bank in a few minutes' time. But firstly, Mahim Rahman is the CEO of Infrazameen Pakistan and is one of the country's first female CEOs in the financial sector.
So I think if you looked at Pakistan about a year ago compared to where Pakistan is today, I think we have transitioned into fragile stability. We are seeing inflation taper off quite fast. We have seen the weakness of the currency at least stabilize over the last 6 months or so. And so on the whole, we are seeing sort of economic activity probably slowly now beginning to move off the bottom, which is where it was about 6 to 8 months ago. So I think we are moving quite rapidly. And I think that's quite a indicator of how quickly things can turn around if the right stabilization measures are being implemented. Of course, I use the word fragile, and I think it's exactly that. The IMF deal will help bolster a lot of that stability. But I think it's now really up to the government to look at some of the deeper areas, especially in terms of tax reform, that will eventually lead to a position where you can consider weaning the economy off the IMF program, so to speak.
For people in the business world like you, does that mean that you feel it's a good time to invest, grow the business now? Is that a sense you're getting from the business community with a bit more stability economically and politically in Pakistan?
So I think the IMF deal was awaited. I think on the margins, investment activity has already improved. So I wouldn't say that it's a broad-based recovery at this point in time. I still think there's significant challenges. But if we look at various different sectors, we are seeing investment activity return. I think the drop in interest rates was a big boost overall to the business community and sort of a signal to the business community that we've passed the worst. We are looking at the upcycle at this point in time, especially if it's going to be a three-year program. We now at least have visibility rather than sort of a 3-6 month visibility. We are looking long-term at 1 to 2 years, which certainly does say that the investment cycle should be coming through if it hasn't already started.
Does it annoy you sometimes that you obviously run a business and you have to balance your books to make sure that you survive, that the people running Pakistan's economy continually don't seem to be able to do that?
think, you know, what businesses have demonstrated in the last 5 years, and we have seen multiple, I think almost three or four changes of government alone in the last 5 years. So I think what gets tricky is to keep up with policy frameworks, in particular taxation frameworks, because those can significantly alter how a business operates, and especially given how tax regimes can fundamentally sort of really shift very quickly, given the change in governments. I think that has been a very frustrating part. But having said that, I think Pakistani corporates have demonstrated tremendous resilience in practically every sector. I think what has struggled is sort of the small scale businesses, the small to medium enterprises that have struggled at high inflation, high costs, and an overall weaker currency. Having said that, you know, I think it's very important that we don't go into a repeat spiral in a couple of years. So while those lessons have certainly been learned with the business community, we would like to see that also translate into the political and policymaking landscape as well, rather than ending up into another spiral cycle again.
Mahim Rahman there. Let's bring in Susan Schmidt, Head of Public Equities at the State of Wisconsin Investment Board. And that is the crucial point here, isn't it? Pakistan, like many emerging economies, has to start balancing its books, because it can't continue going to financial organizations like the IMF to bail them out of trouble, can they, Susan?
That's right. It becomes increasingly difficult the more requests they have to make. And investors lose confidence because they need to see some form of progress be delivered. They also need to see some stability get reached by the country. They want to see consistent reform take place. They want to see that steps are being made that take accountability into hand, and also give those investors, like the IMF in this case, the confidence that should they need to then extend further funds, they'll be used appropriately to get the Pakistani economy back on even footing. And that's what investors, whether it be an organization like the IMF or institutional investors, a pension fund, they're looking for accountability and sustainability of returns.
Yeah, we're going to hear from a former governor of the Pakistan Central Bank in a minute, but listen to this for us, Susan. The new Sri Lankan president, Anuradha Kumar Dissanayake, says his government will restart talks with the IMF immediately over a $2.9 billion bailout loan. In his first televised address to the nation, the left-wing president said he also wanted a deal to restructure Sri Lanka's debt.
The change we seek involves many steps that will take time. However, achieving stability and confidence in the current economy is crucial. We plan to begin negotiations with the International Monetary Fund immediately and proceed with activities related to the extended credit facility. Additionally, to advance our debt restructuring program, we are negotiating with relevant creditors to expedite the process and secure necessary debt relief.
As you said there, Susan, the problem is that if you continually go to borrow money, like we do as individuals, those terms get a little bit more difficult. Is there a lot of scope for these countries to try and negotiate better terms with the IMF? Can't be easy.
It is definitely not easy. And I think that's one of the more difficult conversations that these countries have to have. It's really trying to walk the line so that they can make concessions, they can get a different situation in how their debt is structured to allow them to have the ability to repay it. But at the same time, they want to then show good faith effort and convince the IMF or other lending organizations that they will be able to repay it. So it's a very difficult conversation, and it equally difficult because not only are they talking about a myriad of factors, this isn't one business with one product line. This is a country with an economy that extends across multiple businesses, thousands, millions of different types of organizations and industry. And at the same time, changing politics. And that means changing policy. That also can have a huge impact.
Let's pick up on the point that Susan was talking about there, because Pakistan needs to bring in much more revenue into the country if it wants to balance its books and not go back to the International Monetary Fund. How can it do that? Well, I've been discussing that with Ishrat Hussain, the former governor of the State Bank of Pakistan.
Right now, we have a large repayment to be made for the next 3 years, which is $25 billion every year. So we cannot generate that $25 billion ourselves. We have to go to the creditors like the IMF in order to raise this amount. So it's critical for Pakistan to repay its debt obligations.
When will it not need to go to the IMF? When will the economy be in a strong enough position that it doesn't have to do this?
There is a strategy for exit. If for the next 3 years, the government takes some very tough and very unpopular decisions, one is that we have to increase our export growth rate to 14% a year, which is possible because 2 years ago we had 26% growth, and this August and July we got a 14% growth. But you have to remove all the obstacles facing the exporters. For example, the energy prices and excessive taxation, so exporters can explore new markets and sell new products.
On that energy factor that you talked about there, one of the problems is that the IMF will reduce subsidies, won't they, as part of the deal. So won't those energy prices go up? Won't it get more difficult to do that then?
No, my argument is that the exporters should not cross-subsidize the domestic consumers. That is not what other competing countries are doing. They are providing energy prices at a lower level than for the domestic. Here we are doing the opposite. We are asking the industrial sector and the export sector to subsidize the residential and domestic. They are not producing the exports for earning the foreign exchange. So my argument is that you have to compete with Bangladesh, with Vietnam, with Cambodia, with India. So we should have the same prices.
Does Pakistan also, as it needs to generate more revenue to balance those books, which it's not able to do at the moment, does it need to widen the tax base in Pakistan? There are many who say, look, the rich don't pay enough tax in Pakistan.
You are absolutely right. The agriculture income tax yields almost zilch, although it is 22% of the national income. And the large landlords control about 42% of land, and they are not paying any taxes. The retail wholesale distributors, they don't pay any taxes. They constitute about 18% of the GDP. Similarly, the private transporters, the hospitals, private hospitals, clinic, tuition centers, lawyers, accountants, a lot of professionals don't pay the taxes that are due. So if you bring them into the tax net, Pakistan's tax GDP ratio, I argue, will go up from 10% of GDP to 15%. And that will not then necessitate a huge domestic borrowing.
I was interested. You said Pakistan won't need to go back to the IMF if they follow these measures. They haven't done up to now. Do you think things will be different this time?
Well, I'm just taking them on their statements, both by the Prime Minister as well as the Finance Minister, that this will be the last IMF program.
If Pakistan doesn't break this cycle, it's likely the economy will be stuck where it is. People struggle for jobs. It needs to break this cycle, doesn't it?
In 2000 to 2006, we followed this strategy. Our exports doubled. Our inflation rate was low. And the foreign exchange reserves went up from $300 million to $16 billion. So we have a track record where these measures have actually done the trick.
Ishrat Hussain there, the former governor of the State Bank of Pakistan. Just give you some quick figures. In a nation of over 240 million people, and where most jobs are in the informal sector, only 5.2 million people filed income tax returns in 2022, showing you the scale of the economic challenge there in raising that tax.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's role as the world's leading superpower. The job of U.S. president is one which has great impact beyond its own borders. But Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have very different ideas about the role of the U.S. abroad. What is America's place in the world today? And how would Trump and Harris shape that role? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
revenue. You're with World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. Let's move to the United States, where, of course, the presidential campaign is in full swing. And both candidates have been talking about the most crucial issue for many American voters, which, of course, is the economy. Tonight in Pittsburgh, presidential candidate Kamala Harris made her crucial speech on the economy. Let's hear a bit about her economic vision if she becomes the president.
In this election, I believe we have an extraordinary opportunity to make our middle class the engine of America's prosperity, to build a stronger economy where everyone, everywhere, has a chance to pursue their dreams and aspirations, and to ensure that the United States of America continues to out-innovate and out-compete the world.
However, though she was speaking about the economy there, her rival Donald Trump, if you look at most opinion polls, tends to do better on the economy than Kamala Harris, though that gap is closing. In his speech last night, Donald Trump pledged to raise tariffs.
We're cutting the business tax from 21% to 15%, which makes us the most competitive tax anywhere on the planet, but only for those who make their product in the USA. And we will set up special zones of federal land with ultra-low taxes and regulations for American producers. These will be ideal spots for relocating entire industries that we've taken in from other countries. They're going to come in at levels that nobody's ever seen before. And under my plan, we will cut energy and electricity prices in half within 12 months. And that means for your homes, too. It'll be a renaissance. It'll be a golden period.
Let's have a bit more analysis now of both of those speeches. Let's start with Kamala Harris. I've been speaking to the BBC's North America business correspondent, Michelle Fleury.
I mean, she was very much outlining her vision for what she called an opportunity economy, one that put the middle class at the centre. And what that means in practical terms is things like lowering class, so tax cuts for the middle class, help for parents, new parents, giving access to paid leave for all, helping people with housing. There was also a lot of talk about investing in innovation and entrepreneurship. She made a point of saying that she is a capitalist and that she supports startups, that she wants to see new business applications go up in her first term. She wants to make sure that America wins competition for the 21st century. So the vision that we're seeing emerge here really is about a partnership between government and industry, where you see in some cases the government steering that industry in specific places.
And Donald Trump, he's also been outlining his economic position, hasn't he, over the last 48 hours. Where do they differ a lot? I mean, he talks a lot about tariffs. He talks a lot about rebuilding manufacturing. Are there big differences between the two?
So I think where they're similar is that they both say they want to help the working man and woman. They want to help the middle class. But how they want to go about doing it is profoundly different. And I think that has never been more apparent than in the last sort of 36 hours. As you say, Donald Trump was on the campaign trail yesterday in Georgia, where he was talking about manufacturing. And if you think about his vision, it is one of a more fortress America, right, where you have an unprecedented level of tariffs, where you're talking about mass deportations, where you're talking about lower taxes. So while the goal in some ways of both candidates is similar, how they want to get there is profoundly different. But the reason you're hearing both talk about it so much is that polls lately have started to show that Kamala Harris is closing the gap. For the longest time, Donald Trump has been way in the lead as being seen by voters as being better at handling the economy. He's still leading on that issue, but the gap is narrowing.
That is interesting, isn't it? But do you think less people associate Kamala Harris with the inflation problems than maybe people expected that to be the case, even though she's part of the Biden administration?
It could also just be where we are in the economic cycle. We've just had the Federal Reserve cut rates, in part because it believes a soft landing, or if you listen to economists, they believe a soft landing is in sight. In other words, that we're sort of retreating from those the worst days of inflation, cooling the economy, but not too much that a recession is looming. And so things are going well. If you look at the stock market, obviously not every American draws their wealth from the stock market. But, you know, it's another metric, if you like, that's out there. And it's at record highs at the moment. Because you're seeing things go better on that front, prices starting to sort of, you know, inflation starting to cool, I think that might be feeding into sort of that change in perception and the fact that it is a different candidate.
We had that great phrase, didn't we, during the Clinton campaign. It's the economy, stupid. Is it all about the economy? Is it still going to be the most important factor that decides the election?
It was true when Clinton said it. It's going to be true about this election. Number one issue people are all talking about is the economy.
It is still the economy, isn't it, Susan? When you look at the markets, do they have a favoured candidate, do you think, at the moment?
I think investors are really split on this one still. And we're seeing that in the polls. We're seeing that not just in the investor base, but in the entire American demographic. We have a very limited amount of time to gather information about the Harris campaign and the positions and policies that she might adapt and wants to promote and put forward. We started to hear a little bit more detail about it today. Certainly, as she's becoming more known as a candidate, we're seeing the odds even out between the two contenders and between President Trump and Vice President Harris. And so I think the market still would like a lot more detail and would like a lot more meat behind these plans. They both have made some very big statements, but it's the follow through and the thinking through the details that investors really want to see to try and get a better sense of it.
Well, still some time to go in the campaign, so you can pore over all the words that they say for it, Susan, and analyze it for us. Right. The U.S. plane maker Boeing is in the news once again, this time because of a warning from the U.S. safety regulator, the Federal Aviation Administration. Mike Whitaker, its head, told politicians in the Senate in the U.S. that he won't let the company boost production until it addresses a series of safety issues which could impact the company's profits. Joining us once again is Ed Pearson, Executive Director for the Foundation for Aviation Safety and a former senior manager at Boeing. And it strikes me, Ed, great to have you on the program once again, that basically you've been saying what Mike Whitaker's been saying for quite a long time, haven't you?
Well, thanks for having me. And yes, I do feel like it's been a repetitive statement. You know, today's hearing with the Senate was supposed to reassure the public and the flying public. And unfortunately, I walked away with feeling exactly the opposite. It was very discouraging.
Why do you feel the opposite? And is it not just about Boeing here? You disappointed with the Federal Aviation Administration. They were criticized, weren't they, in a sense, for not doing enough to tackle this problem much earlier?
Right. It's extremely frustrating because our FAA is supposed to be overseeing and you know, monitoring Boeing's manufacturing operations. And the steps that they've taken since the Alaska accident, and I would argue they should have taken these steps before the MAX disasters, the steps that they've taken are really weak. I mean, for example, they keep saying that they've capped the production of Boeing 737 MAX airplanes at 38 a month when the company has only been able to produce, you know, 23 a month. And so that's really a meaningless cap. And even the 23 that they're producing doesn't mean that, you know, because it's under that 38 that they're necessarily safe. They've also made a big deal about these key performance indicators, this data metrics that are supposed to give them, you know, early warning that the problems are occurring in the factory. Well, I got to tell you, those metrics, we had dozens and dozens of metrics before the MAX disasters. The problem was the executives would always rationalize the schedule over stopping the line.
What should they be doing?
So that's a useless effort.
You're not happy with this.
Yeah.
I mean, Boeing continually seems to be in the middle of safety issues. What does the FAA need to do? What does Boeing need to do to get its reputation back?
Well, that's a big question, but let me start with the FAA. The FAA has 11 individuals working at the busiest airplane factory in the world, and that factory has thousands of employees working 7 days a week. And I'm not kidding when I say that's not enough people to monitor the restaurant operations at the site. So number one, FAA has 45,000 people. They have a Northwest headquarters that has 800 people, literally 15 minutes away from the factory. And all they've been able to put into that factory is 11 people, which is just laughable. So that's one thing they need to do. We actually met with the head of the FAA back in March. Our foundation did, and also the number two person at the Department of Transportation. And we said that you need to have at least 100 people in that one building. Because there's 30 different flow days in the building, and each of those flow days are really complex operations. And having 11, mind you, this is a round-the-clock operation, right? Seven days a week, three shifts. So that's number one, is the steps that the FAA are taking to the uninformed, you know, individuals are not really aware of what's going on. It may sound impressive, but it's really terrible. As far as Boeing is concerned, you know, we were very disappointed. The new CEO had an opportunity to prevent the strike. But really what's been going on really shows that the senior levels of the company still don't understand what's happening on the front line with employees. Those employees we're in touch with every day, and they share with us issues that they're seeing with parts, quality control, pressure from above. I mean, there's a lot of talk and very little action of fixing things. So, I wish I could report better news, but right now this is just an illusion of safety.
Okay, stay there, because you mentioned the workers, and of course that new offer has been rejected, hasn't it, by those workers. Let's hear from one of them. John Rifle is a Boeing worker. He said the company had gone behind their back and hadn't received an offer directly.
I'm not going to think about anything on word of mouth or on a handshake. We want it in writing. We need to review, because something that's not talked about is all the fine print. Right? We need to look at what's been scratched out or what's been changed. But when they just throw out this what might look good to the public, just to try to make us look like we're greedy, when we're not. We're not greedy. I have quite a unique occupation here. There's nothing like it. So we just want to be compensated fairly.
I'm going to come back to Ed very shortly. Susan, 20 seconds for you. Looking at that Boeing share price over 5 years, down 60%. And until they get better news, it's going to continue to go down.
That's right. What Boeing has going for it in investors' minds is there's a clear need for aviation equipment. We need more planes. We have aging stock in the air. People are flying. We need to replace them. There are very few companies that can do that. However, Boeing isn't doing themselves any favors. They continue to have negative headlines, and they need to clean this up before investors are willing to give them the benefit of any doubt.
And last word to you, Ed, 30 seconds. Are they about to turn this around, do you think?
No, I'm sorry to say that I think that the company steps that they're taking are woefully inadequate, and they're not listening to their employees. And the union member that was talking, I think, was absolutely correct. They deserve to be compensated better, because if better compensated employees, they're also going to be better trained, they're going to be better motivated, and they really are the backbone of the company. And unfortunately, the executives, you know, their focus remains on the Wall Street you know, focus.
Okay, Ed, thanks very much for joining us once again here on the program. We'll be back with Business Matters in a couple of hours' time, continuing our focus on Pakistan. That's it for World Business Report.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at America's role as the world's leading superpower. The job of U.S. president is one which has great impact beyond its own borders. But Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have very different ideas about the role of the U.S. abroad. What is America's place in the world today? And how would Trump and Harris shape that role? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.